crazy, all for the love of you.
Hello, my friends, and thank you for tuning into the Duncan Trussell Family Hour. I have some terrifying news for you. So if you're stoned right now or under the influence of any kind of psychedelic substance at all, including coffee, just skip ahead to the Tom Rhodes interview. I only want you to hear this if you're stone cold sober. But even then, you probably shouldn't listen to it. So everyone, skip ahead. This is going to fuck up your consciousness. This is going to mess up your life. It's going to pry open your third eye with a crowbar of truth and leave you more than likely writhing naked in the middle of the closest intersection to your house or apartment, screaming at the sky, bellowing out for someone, anything, to stop the horrible onslaught of truth that is now cascading through the neural canyons of your brain and into your pineal gland, causing it to ejaculate dimethyltryptamine all over the gasping, slutty face of your superego. This is some heavy-duty shit. And it starts with Nick Bostrom. Nick Bostrom is a philosopher at Oxford University, and he is an expert on what we call the singularity, or the point where computers wake up. Here's a sound clip that I found on the internet of Nick Bostrom talking about the eventuality of humans being able to download their minds into computers.
So this is the what's in technical terminology, whole brain emulation, or in more popular jargon, uploading. And so obviously it's impossible now, but it seems that it's consistent with everything we know about physics and chemistry and so forth. So I think that will become feasible, you know, barring some kind of catastrophic thing that puts a stop to scientific and technological progress. So the way I imagine it would work is that you would take a particular brain, freeze it or vitrify it, and then slice it up into thin slices that would be fed through some array of microscopes that would scan each slice with sufficient resolution, and then automated image analysis algorithms would work on this to reconstruct the three-dimensional neuronal network that the original organic brain implemented. And I have this as a sort of computer information structure in a computer. At this point, you need computational neuroscience to tell you what each component does. So you need to have a good theory of what, a pyramidal cell does, what the, you know, different kinds of... And then you would combine those little computational models of what each type of neuron does with this three-dimensional map of the network and run it. And if everything went well, you would then have transferred the mind with memories and personalities intact to the computer. And there's an open question of just how much resolution would you need to have, like how much detail would you need to capture of the original mind and actually to successfully do this. But I think that would be some level of detail, which, as I said before, might be on the level of synapses or thereabouts, possibly higher, that would suffice. So then you would be able to do this. And then after your software, of course, you could be copied or speeded up or slowed down or pulsed and stuff like that.
Pulsed. Did you guys hear him just say that? Pulsed. He just casually threw out that if we don't end up blowing ourselves up because the Sarah Palins of the world manage to get their slutty, manicured, fundamentalist, Christian, psychopathic fingers on the detonation button of some nuclear arsenal, we can end up getting to the point where we could put our brains into high-tech deli machines / scanners and have our neurology downloaded into a computer. That could happen. And here's where it gets weird. It may have already happened. Dr. S. James Gates, the professor of physics and director of the Center for String and Particle Theory at the University of Maryland, has discovered something deep inside the superstring equations that he has been working on. Listen to this and get ready for your brain to melt out of your ears, down your back, and into the mouth of your cat.
These are pictures of equations. I've been, for the last 15 years, trying to answer the kinds of questions that my colleagues here have been raising. And what I've come to understand is that there are these incredible pictures that contain all the information of a set of equations that are related to string theory. And it's even more bizarre than that, because when you then try to understand these pictures, you find out that buried in them are computer codes just like the type that you find in a browser when you go surf the web.
You're saying your attempt to understand the fundamental operations of nature leads you to a set of equations that are indistinguishable from the equations that drive search engines and browsers on our computers.
That is correct. So,
Wait. I have to just be silent for a minute here. So you're saying as you dig deeper, you find computer code writ in the fabric of the cosmos.
Into the equations that we want to use to describe the cosmos, yes.
Computer code.
Computer code, strings of bits of ones and zeros.
It's not just sort of resembles computer code, you're saying it is computer code.
It's not even just is computer code, it's a special kind of computer code that was invented by a scientist named Claude Shannon in the 1940s. That's what we find very, very deeply inside the equations that occur in string theory and in general in systems that we could say are supersymmetric.
Friends, you have to bear in mind that this is not coming from someone smeared with hash butter and body glitter at the freakout tent at Burning Man. This is coming from very well-respected scientists, one of them postulating that there is a high probability that if we don't blow ourselves up, we're going to end up uploading our brains into computers, and the other saying that he's found digital code in the very depths of his superstring equations. Digital code that seems to have been invented in the 1940s. What does this imply? It implies that you and I and everyone you know are all part of a simulation being run inside a machine. For the longest time, we've always wondered and thought about what will happen when computers wake up. Now we're beginning to see that we are the computer waking up. We are the computer gaining consciousness of itself. So enjoy the Olympics. Just because you're a computer simulation being run in some sweaty piss kid's crap apartment in New York on his Xbox 78 billion doesn't mean that you can't look cool. Why not go to DuncanTrussell.com and buy one of my amazing posters or t-shirts or some stickers from the shop? It helps keep this little part of the simulation running, and it helps you look like a champion of the simulator. The shirts are incredible. Why are they so incredible? Because they're made by our sponsor, Sure Design T-Shirts. Sure Design T-Shirts is located in the part of the simulation known as Thailand, and the reason the shirts are so soft is because they climb up into the caves of Thailand and capture the cutest little pixel puppies that exist there and take them back down into the Sure Design T-Shirt factories and bang them on the head with pixelated hammers, much like the ones you see in Mario Brothers. The puppies cry and they use their tears as part of the slurry that makes up the ones and zeros that we currently at this part of the simulation call t-shirts. So go to SureDesignT-Shirts.com and type in my name, Duncan, and you'll get 10% off. SureDesignT-Shirts.com. We love them. Support them. And finally, if you want to distract yourself from the fact that you are just one tiny little infinitesimal part of some super advanced supercomputer freaking itself out, then you can go to audible.com and download a free audiobook. Go to audibletrial.com/familyhour and sign up for a temporary membership. You will get one free audiobook, and I'm telling you, it's perfect for keeping your pixelated ass on the treadmill so that you can get a pixelated six-pack and start getting some pixelated... So go to audibletrial.com/familyhour. They give us $15 every time you download one of these audiobooks. And finally, to you who have been selflessly donating to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour and helping to support this podcast, I sincerely, from the depths of my holographic heart, thank you. We may be inside a series of circuits and digital projections, but I still feel gratitude towards you for helping to support what has become my number one obsession in the simulation, which is this podcast. Thank you so much for sending me the amazing gifts that you've been sending to my post office box. And thank you for blasting me with the ones and zeros that in this part of the machine represent money. It keeps this thing going, and I love you very much for it. May the programmer smile upon you and send simulated blessings your way, so that while the energy still runs through the circuits that we call this universe, you can experience pure novelty and maybe even fist somebody one day. I hope so. Okay, enough of that computer crap. Let's get down to the show. Today's guest, the only way to describe today's guest is that he's a cool motherfucker and a legend. His name's Tom Rhodes. He's had his own show on NBC called Mr. Rhodes. He's an international performer. He's performed in Bangkok, Tokyo, Vancouver, Stockholm, Sydney, all over. He travels the entire planet, and he's got his own podcast called Tom Rhodes Radio. He's been on The Tonight Show. He's had his own Comedy Central Presents. He's released many albums. And most importantly, he's incredibly funny. And even more important than that, he's a super cool fucking guy. So everyone, please extend the sweetest love of your simulated computer hearts to whatever part of the simulator Tom Rhodes happens to be being projected into. And welcome, Tom Rhodes, to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour. Welcome.
You know, this podcast hasn't even started yet, and it's already my favorite because you offered me a fruit smoothie.
Well, yeah, they're the best. They're so fucking important, man. Like, you can't underestimate the potency of a high-powered blender in your life. Like, I think it exceeds the mythical hot tub that everyone dreams about. I think it's better than having a hot tub.
I think it's so California, you know. I come over, you make me a fruit smoothie. It's delicious. We're standing on your porch, perfect sunny day.
Yep.
And you're talking about the bitterness of show business. I just thought that was the quintessential California moment.
Oh, you're right. I did like, go into the bitterness.
Life is perfect, but let's talk about things that make us unhappy.
Oh, my God. I am so fucking guilty of that. Oh, my God. What an you really are illuminating things in the most severe and honest way possible. You're so right. But let me describe the scene. You guys. Beautiful, beautiful day today. It's not too hot. Nice blue skies. We're standing in front of the hammock on the porch in my fucking house drinking delicious smoothies.
Absolute paradise.
I'm fucking complaining. Thank you, master.
No, it wasn't complaining. It was just, you know,
it's what comedians do.
We were talking about showbiz. And
right. But it is still, no, man. That's
but I thought it was interesting because you were saying that, you know, because we were talking about podcasts and how great it is. That,
yeah.
You know, you can reach people and you can do your own thing, and that the paradigm in show business forever has been this, like, you know, small group of corporate suit people who decide
yes.
what people hear or see. And
yes.
That made me think of John Travolta and his scandal of, you know, he's of whatever, all these masseuses saying that, you know, he's sticking his ass up in the air. And he told that one guy supposedly that Hollywood's run by gay Jewish guys and that, you know, he's done all these sexual favors for these parts. So I just, you know, picture him being like this, like, sperm fountain so he
yes.
can get these roles. And
yes.
That kind of disgusts me. I would prefer to think of it more like he's just at a higher level of Scientology than any of us will ever understand.
I don't think that hurts. Hey, I don't think that necessarily hurts.
He wasn't doing it for the roles. It's just a
yeah.
It's part of the L. Ron Hubbard plan.
Well, the truth of the matter is that in every aspect of society, when people group to work together, they tend to be more successful than people who don't work together. And unfortunately, A lot of times that manifests in the form of some pretty monolithic fucked systems, you know, and maybe that's Scientology, whatever. I mean, Scientology, you do have a network of people all focused on whatever the fuck they're focused on, the Thetans, and part of that is also the fact that many of those people have pretty powerful jobs in the business, you know, and so clearly if you're making a decision about who gets the part, that's going to play a tiny little part of it, if not like a huge part.
Well, I'm just glad I didn't have to do anything like that to get on your podcast.
Well, you gotta say that, don't you?
Oh, just to clarify.
Oh, how great that'll be. The day that people have to fuck me to get on my podcast will be a glorious day for me. Where the people I'm looking across from them, they're kind of like confused. They keep tearing up because of the horrible things I just did to them. They're ruined. They're trying to black out.
Been deloused, and now it's guest time.
That'd be great, man, but that happens. How fucking crazy is that that happens? That really happens all the time where people get fucked. They literally get fucked. Like, they get their assholes filled with someone's cock that they have no interest in other than wanting a job so bad.
Oh.
That's insane, man. I mean,
that's the sad economic reality of the world that we live in.
Yes, that really happens. You're just shoved up against some anonymous wall, feeling a guy's pulsing cock in your asshole as he moans, and you're like, I'm just going to do this once. I'm only going to do this once. I'm going to get this fucking part.
I see you're just saying that over and over to yourself as it's happening. I'm just going to do this once. I just want to move to a better apartment. Just need a little bit more money every month.
I just need to be able to afford my diabetes medication. Oh, yeah, that happens, man. That is the... That does happen.
I don't know how we went from fruit smoothies to anal rape.
It's a pretty easy bridge. It's not that far a trip. It's not like even it's not flying across the country to get there. I can always get to anal rape. There's always a quick access point to that. I gotten this. What do you think? I just gotten this like ridiculous Facebook stupid back and forth fight with people who think that the CIA was behind the shooter who went to that theater.
Oh, I heard something like that yesterday, that the FBI had brainwashed a guy and hypnotized him. And, you know, you heard that about
John Lennon?
No, the guy that Lee Harvey Oswald killing Kennedy.
Yes.
That was always a conspiracy thing like that. And Sirhan with, yes, Robert Kennedy.
Yes.
I mean,
Project Monarch.
That's what look at the guy, the kid, the Colorado shooting, that human turd. Anytime there, yes, whenever there's a shooting by some loser, and it's, you know, guns don't kill people, losers kill people. I mean, we shouldn't have, I'm not against guns, but I'm against, like, why should someone have machine guns? This guy bought his machine gun at this Gander Mountain store, and they're all over the country.
Yes.
So anybody can get their hands on a machine gun. I think that, you know, you see the guy sitting there. Whenever there's a shooting, you should never say the man's name in the media. They should only refer to these people,
yes,
as the human turd.
I call him the Earl.
So you got the human turd that did the Colorado,
yes,
shootings. You got the human turd that did the Fort Hood shootings.
Yes.
The human turd that did the Norway shootings.
Yes.
That should be our media standard.
Love it.
Only refer to them as human turds.
Maybe make them wear some kind of mask.
Turd hat?
A turd hat or a dunce hat. I call him
He already had that because he looked like, what is it? And he said he was the Joker.
He dyed his hair
And he
orange.
Dyed his hair orange. And he's sitting there looking like Krusty the Clown. And
yes.
That was pathetic.
He's a dunce. He's a moron.
And obviously the guy wasn't that big of a fan, or at least he'd have watched the first showing. Wait, wasn't he interested in what hell? He's not going to see that movie for fucking 20 years.
No, he'll never. Unless they're screening that in hell, he's, yeah, not seeing that movie. That guy's definitely getting executed.
What kind of super fan doesn't watch the first fucking?
You know what?
The final episode.
I bet he thought about that as he was like going to the... getting hauled away. That probably came in his mind. He's like, wait, I should have waited till the end of the fucking movie. Why didn't I fucking wait? I think it's ridiculous that people think that the CIA used scopolamine, which is what people are saying. They use some kind of hypnotic drug, brainwash this guy. Because what people are saying is, well, he had a $20,000 arsenal and he was on unemployment. How could he afford that? Now, first of all, anyone can get on fucking unemployment. Because you're on unemployment doesn't mean that you don't have fucking money. They don't look in your bank account when you get on unemployment.
Or if he did it within the last 3 months, he got all that ammunition. Maybe he could have just applied for a credit card and like maxed it out. And I'm going to fucking kill anybody who gives a shit.
Yeah.
But
and it wasn't a $20,000 arsenal. It was more like $11,000 worth of shit that he used. So it wasn't $20,000. It was $11,000. He could have gotten a loan from the bank. He could have had an inheritance. He could have had savings. He could have stolen it or robbed it. Why do people go to the fucking CIA? I do this exact same thing when I see something in the sky. When I see some weird thing in the sky, the first thing I think is, oh, that's a UFO.
Yeah, right.
The most improbable possibility of all the possibilities of what could be in the sky, the least probable that you're seeing is a fucking UFO. In the same way, the most probable thing and the most terrifying thing and a million times more freakish than the CIA training some psychopath is that that motherfucker just decided to start shooting a lot of people. That, to me, is so much more scarier than the CIA training.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's just it's frightening and evil enough on its own. And, you know, it's September 11th, all this conspiracy theory, the government, it was a big bank robbery, there was a bunch of gold under building, whatever. Yeah. And you know, have you ever been to the post office? That's government employees. I don't think I know people that work in the government. They're regular people. I don't think our government has its shit together enough to do something like that. I'll tell you how lame our government is.
How?
Guantanamo Bay, you know, they were torturing all these people.
Yes.
I Googled top torture songs. For Guantanamo Bay, I was just curious. You know, it popped in my mind one day. I was like, oh, I wonder what, you know, we use and to torture people. And there's a song. The number one song was called Fuck Your God by some metal death band called Deicide or something like that. Deicide, however you say it. But now that makes perfect sense. But, like, number two was, We Will Rock You.
Wow.
We Are the Champions. Are you that Brian May guitar riff?
So wait,
I could listen to that over and over.
Hold on. You're saying that in Guantanamo Bay,
the songs that we tortured people with,
they're torturing people by playing We Will Rock You? I didn't know that.
Right.
That was
and
happening.
Also another one was Don McLean's American Pie, which, okay, that would get, I think the Madonna version of that, I would snap. But I mean, you look how lame our government is. We can't even like, choose good songs to torture people with.
Wait, I'm sorry, man. I don't mean to keep going back to this. I feel really dumb, but I had no idea that we were using popular songs to torture these people. I didn't realize that was happening. Is that really happening?
Yeah, and there's been other incidences where they've blasted
the
music.
Koresh, they blasted the compound with,
right,
with
like AC/DC and shit like that, which I'm a huge AC/DC fan. I wouldn't have been a problem.
I think over time, I know they did Rabbits Screaming. They played that into the fucking compound, rabbits.
I didn't know rabbits screamed.
I think they scream when they're dying. I think they played dying animal sounds and played that into the fucking compound. Now that freaks me the fuck out, man, because there are kids in there, you know, and like when I think about that, like what you just said, the paradigm of the clumsy government. Is something that it's like you have these two options or like somewhere in between. You have one option, which is it's a blundering, fool-filled government. They couldn't possibly pull.
Or that they're constantly doing evil and perpetuating like conspiracies.
Right.
And sinister plots.
Sinister plots. Now, I think that probably the reality is it's actually they are trying to do sinister plots, but they're bumbling idiots at the same time, and so it ends up, you know what I mean, it's like a mix of bumbling idiots trying to do these things that sometimes work and sometimes fail. There are documents that are apparently real that show that there were times that the government was going to do its own terrorist attack against itself, and this shit's come up in Congress. You can find it on the internet. I can't remember what it's called.
That's an ancient thing. I mean, the Germans did that. They set the forget what it's called, on fire, and blame the Jewish people.
That's right.
Apparently, the Gulf of Tonkin incident that started Vietnam never happened.
Right.
And then the Spanish-American War, I think, was the first time we did it, where there was it was the exact same thing. There was a boat in the harbor in Cuba outside of Havana.
Yes.
And we said it was attacked. And then we, you know, go to war with the Spanish and get Cuba and the Philippines and stuff. So that I could believe.
Right.
That we would do things like that to start wars. And, but, you know, little individual things of Americans slaughtering each other. I don't think so.
Well, the idea is he did it because they want to take our weapons away from us. That's like the
human turd said that?
The human turd didn't say anything. He just sort of bobbed around in court and his eyes rolled back. It seemed like he was on ecstasy or something. He was like fucking high as a kite on something in court. He didn't say anything, but the conspiracy theorists are saying, no, this is designed to remove guns from the people. But what I think, and what really is another scary thing, is I don't think the fucking government, I think people have gotten so dumb and slovenly and non-revolutionary and scared of doing anything as long as they're comfortable and have their TVs and their fucking food, that the government doesn't need to stage shootings in theaters to take away guns. I think if the government wanted to in a couple of fucking months, they could just take the fucking guns away. I don't think they need to stage this shit. I think they could just do whatever they want at this point. I mean, look at that fucking, what's it called? The act that they just did where you can get arrested indefinitely, indefinite detention. You know about that, right? Mm-mm. Oh, yeah. It's like the whole country is considered a battleground and anyone can be arrested. They shifted it and changed it a little bit, but they also made it so that if you protest near a federal building, you can get arrested. You can just get taken away from protesting near a federal building. They pass these fucking laws all the time.
And that's how they control people in the third world, too, is like people can't gather in groups larger than three or five. You know, anything more than that's a protest.
Yes.
So the whole concept of protest is stripped away.
Stripped away. You must have a better perspective on this shit than I do, man, because you have, as far as I'm concerned, the ultimate life of a comedian. You're an international comedian. You've done that thing where you're not locked down into like touring around in the United States, but you tour everywhere. You live everywhere. I guess you're a United States citizen, right? You don't have dual citizenship, but you perform in Paris, Amsterdam. You've been on TV shows and on Europe. What's going on here in the United States? You're in orbit, man. You can look down and give me the Google Maps story of what's happening here.
Well, the great thing about comedy now is that it's exploding in the United States again. It's really popular.
Right.
And that's because everyone's depressed and out of work.
Right.
We need a laugh. Yeah. I mean, it's cyclical and it's time. I guess the last collapse was in the early 90s or whatever.
Yes.
I mean, you know, the strong survived. And, the good clubs and good comedians never went away. But, it's spread all over the world. And stand-up comedy is really popular. A lot of British people, a lot of the best world circuits are booked out of London, like this Hong Kong tour, a lot of stuff in Australia, gigs around Europe. So cracking London is the key. And the Comedy Store specifically is one of the greatest clubs on earth. And if you get in there, a lot of other stuff just naturally happens. But people are predicting that the British scene is about to implode.
Really?
Because they've been on a high for 20 years.
Forever, yeah.
And that it was that incident with Jonathan Ross and Russell Brand, where they were on like BBC Radio like 5-6 years ago, and they like called some actor. He wasn't there, some older guy, and like left, you know, some dirty message that they had porked his granddaughter or something. So there was a big scandal, and then all the powers that be in England just wanted clean cut comedians and people who weren't controversial. So on the mainstream media there, they've had a lot of that. And so that's why people are predicting that, you know, people might be getting over it in England.
Weird.
So, and it's, I don't know, it seems like a seesaw. When our comedy went down, theirs went up for the last 20 years, and now theirs seems to be dipping, and ours is going back
up. Do you think a lot of that has to do with Russell Brand's shitty fucking show, Brand X, is just humiliating the entire fucking...
Have you seen it?
Yeah, it's foul. Have you seen it?
I actually went to a taping a week ago.
I'm not a fan. Not a fan. It's a little poopy to me, but hey,
Well, it seems like, he's doing stand-up, basically, And I haven't seen W. Kamau Bell's show. I love him. He's one of my favorite human beings. But it seems like he's got a little stand-up setup thing, and then Russell Brand's trying to do that, which I think is an interesting way to do a show. But I went to that Russell Brand taping, which is only like about a mile and a half, 2 miles from your house.
No shit.
Where they tape that.
That's amazing.
It's very close to here.
That explains why the dogs start howling at a certain part of the day. And
I did.
I
met Lee Camp. You know Lee Camp?
No, I don't.
He's a really political guy. And he's from Virginia. He lives in New York City. And he was in Satiristas. I was in that book as well. That's where I first heard of him. But I did his podcast, and he's friends with the sidekick on Russell Brand's show.
He's like a genius.
Harvard,
yeah.
Genius, intelligent guy. So we went to the taping just for that.
Yes.
And so he likes to involve the audience, and he's talking to this guy, Russell Brand. But I guess the episode we saw was about sex. And so there was a lot of like porn actresses,
yes,
in the audience and different people that he keeps talking to. And then they did this thing at the very end. And the taping ran like 2 hours.
Ugh.
And, you know, you can't leave. He did something where he brought this guy down from the audience. And some porn actress woman volunteered that she would give him a blowjob. And Russell Brand, like, you know, instigated it. And then they bring him on. And everyone votes. Do you want him to do it? And everybody's, yes.
Yeah.
You know, and then it dragged on. Okay, well, people feel uncomfortable if it happened out here on the stage. We'll send him in the back. Maybe we'll do a camera close-up on his face. And this bit went on forever.
Ugh.
And the taping was already like an hour and 45 minutes.
Yes.
Now we're like past the two-hour mark.
Sure.
Of this TV taping. And I almost stood up and went, because he's like, I don't know. Should we vote again? And I almost like stood up and went, look, I'll suck his dick. Let's end this bit. Let's fucking end this bit. I'll blow him. It's done. It's a wrap. Let's end this.
Well, that was their big bit. I could see him back there. I could see the writer's room. Oh, yeah, we're going to get someone to blow somebody. It's brilliant. It's brilliant. Yeah, it's I don't know,
but
man.
Maybe they edit that down to a 22-minute show. Maybe it looks, you know, that happened in like 1.5 minutes, but
that kind of like, what's going on there, man? Like, you know, you see, it feels like there's this shift happening in comedy towards like just becoming like more and more like real on stage, more and more yourself instead of character-y, you know? Like, you know, I like The Daily Show. I don't like it as much as I used to like it, but Louis C.K. was just on there with Jon Stewart. And Louis C.K., what he's doing is him. If you see him not on stage, he's the same person as on stage.
Right.
That's who he is. But then you see him next to Jon Stewart, and Jon Stewart's doing that kind of like bug-eyed, like, well, I don't know. That cartoony thing, the shticky thing, right? And it seems so glaring. It seems so much more clownish than, especially when he's right next to someone who's superiorly funny, in my opinion, and is like just a normal guy. And the same thing with fucking Russell Brand. He's doing that kind of like, he's like a brilliant wizard cracking the code of the universe, tortured by his own brilliance. Ah, his mind's going to blow. It's that thing where it's like, yeah, I don't know that's how you are. I think you might be like doing some smoke and mirrors to us. And it feels like whatever's happening with all of humanity right now is like the people who are putting on those kinds of acts just seem more and more like charlatans than even the fucking president. Like Obama. Like when you see Obama do his speech thing, it's like, what is that? Who talks like that? Nobody talks like that. What are you fucking...
Well, when he ran for president, I thought, oh, wow, if he's president, we'll get these grand speeches all the time. Well, we don't really get these grand speeches all the time.
No. Well, no, those backfired or people just are not buying it anymore. But when you see fucking Romney talk, it's the same thing. It's like, who the fuck? No one talks like that. Why are you... Like, you know, when you see soap opera actors act...
Right.
And it's
right.
Like, this is not the way humans behave.
Right.
So kings, presidents, leaders, Russell Brand, Jon Stewart, they're all putting on this thing that isn't really who they are.
And that's interesting. I mean, you know, I amp up my character on stage. You know, I get a little more Southern and preacher sounding, and Russell.
Yeah,
Russell,
but you don't know, man. No. I mean, we all, of course, you're going to amp it up a little bit. I mean, you're not going to take a fucking nap up there, and you're surrounded by fucking people. I'm not going to, if I acted like myself on stage, I'd just be jerking off the internet.
Well, I know.
Porn.
Well, I've thought about that. People go, beat yourself. What, even jack off alone in a hotel room?
Where's the lotion? How come this hotel doesn't have lotion? No, man. I mean, it's like what you're doing is
your mailman has a pith helmet.
Does he?
And he's wearing shorts.
It's a dangerous neighbor.
You want to tell me how tough life is again? This evil business that we're in. God.
Oh, it's a nightmare. It's a nightmare. The horror of it.
I'm ready for Mr. Furley to come knock on the door looking for his rent.
There'd be dead bodies in his basement. I assure you, it's all hidden. It's all under the fucking. It's all under the floorboard.
I like Russell Brand's overall. You know, we're all one human family.
I love that
kind of hippie vibe thing.
Sure.
You know, John Stewart. I mean, you think about what a great time it is, the fantasy of the 14-year-old boy that I was, loving comedy, growing up with comedy albums. It's like now there's a news show that's comedy.
Yes.
The Daily Show.
Yeah.
There's a newspaper, The Onion.
Yeah.
You know, there's just podcasts. There's so much, like, accessible, great comedy.
Yeah.
I think it's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah, I do too, man. I mean, it's definitely an incredible renaissance for performers right now, just because we have access to the technology that used to only be accessible by people who had shitloads of money, and we're going to use the technology to sell fucking cars and antidepressants, and that shifted the tone of the stuff they have. But it's like something's happening. Maybe it's like the technology is doing it. Maybe it's the access to everyone connecting with each other that we're finally seeing. Like, no, you know, the way people act is really a lot different than the way politicians tend to act. And the way people act is a lot different than the way, you know, the old style of performance used to be. Maybe people are becoming less and less interested in that. They want to feel like they're tuning in to the real thing. By the way, I fucking love The Daily Show. I think it's great.
And yeah.
Jon Stewart's character is, I mean, whatever. It's fucking, that show, I love a lot of what that show does, and I like really respect him when he.
Then I think you should apologize to him
right now. I am so sorry, Jon Stewart. No, but when you see.
No, but I do think it's, you know, maybe you've opened my eyes. I think it's an interesting thought that maybe we're moving to being more real.
Yeah.
And that is what this fucking country needs.
Right.
Is a little more honesty, a little more people looking each other in the eyes and talking honestly.
Right.
Instead of our. You know, you always hear Europeans say that Americans are too polite to tell you how they really feel about something.
Right.
You know, how are you? I'm fine.
Yes.
You know.
That doesn't happen everywhere?
Yes, but something we're known for, that we're just very polite people.
Right. Well, it's because we're so fucking
festive. And we wait until it's safe to give your real opinion.
Yes.
Until you're like, okay, well, now I know this guy a little bit better.
Right. That's when you start shit talking. But, you know, man, it's like, I think a lot of people are so filled with fucking existential maggots and rot that to ask them how they feel is similar to like squeezing an infected cyst. You can't just one little opening and it'll erupt with such foulness that hours of
But isn't that where the art comes from?
Yeah, you got to know how to turn
the existential maggots.
Yes, the existential maggots are
produces the good stuff.
That's my muse. Just one big fat existential maggot. But yeah, man, I think that what's happening is like, you know, there's just two different paradigms of performance and two different paradigms of like being an entertainer. The old paradigm was the entertainers were kind of like on this weird, inaccessible fucking pedestal. They were kept away from society. Like, I saw this incredible Vice TV documentary about this guy in Siberia who's, who people think is Jesus. And he's got this beautiful fucking cult going on up there. I mean, it is beautiful. It, like, is a, the most beautiful cult I've ever seen. They, like, everyone's dances and sings. And I'm sure he's fucking everybody out there or whatever, doing classes.
Why else start a cult?
Why would he? Yeah, that's the only reason. But what he does is he's got this nice little Tolkien-esque cottage up in the hills, and every once in a while he'll come down and like wave to them from the woods and then go back up into the cottage. But he never's down. He doesn't hang out with them that much, because how are you going to convey to the people that you're Jesus if you're actually sitting with them at lunch, you know, talking? Because right away you're like, wait, you're not Jesus, you're just a normal fucking guy. Well, the celebrity culture used to be like that, where the celebrities were put in the same little Tolkien-esque cottage in some place, and they would come out for press conferences every once in a while, but they were sequestered away from the world. And then we have the emergence of Twitter and Facebook.
Yeah, you can. People are very accessible.
Yes, now they're accessible, and so some of them are fucking going down in flames. Like, immediately through their tweets, they're like, right, the first thing they tweet is, oh, I love fighting dogs. I just love watching dogs rip the throats out of other dogs. It's like the first thing they tweet.
Come on.
No, but you know, at some level of that, like all the work that the networks would do in the past to keep these fucking freaks
the images
sequestered,
and the photos that get out. Yeah, I think that's. You're absolutely right, and I think it's a really cool thing. Like, on my Twitter, I just got into it in the last year.
Yeah,
but. I look, you know, you look up people that you like, and I really like Van Morrison, and yeah. I'm sure he doesn't do his account.
Right.
But, like, you know, I played in Dublin a month and a half ago, and I tweeted to him, you know, hey, I left you two tickets at the free tickets are at the box office in your name all week while I'm in Dublin.
Cool.
I mean, you know, maybe the guy, maybe he's having a tough time and needs a chuckle.
Sure.
You never know.
Yeah,
you know?
And if he knew anything about fucking comedy, he'd come to your goddamn show.
Yeah, and so, like, a couple weeks ago, Van Morrison tweeted, or his assistant in charge of his Twitter, you know, new Van Morrison record coming out, like, you know, in a couple days, and I'm like, keep it coming, Van. You know, like, I'm having, like, I'm actually having a conversation with the guy. Like, I know him.
Yeah, yeah, right. It's just the fucking record.
You could never
label.
Do that before.
It's the
you
record.
You know, 10, 15 years ago, I'd had to write a letter to the sure. record label, and you know, they never would have.
But meanwhile, I mean, the odds are very good that Van Morrison right now is just buried in Thai hookers in some fucking brothel. Just a fucking buffet of teenage anuses being brought in front. He's not fucking tweeting. It's like a 17-year-old right. intern who, like, and I don't think record labels understand how devastating that bit of laziness can be, because the internet's very savvy, and right away they know, oh, that's not Van Morrison. That's just some fucking robot. That's probably something built in MIT. It's probably a rat brain that's just transmitting fucking Van Morrison tweets. But more and more, I think people are starting to really want to, like, connect with what the real person is, what the thing is under the shell. And it reminds me of when silent movies went to talkies, because
big jump and people being left behind.
People get left behind because some of them had a terrible fucking voice. They might be beautiful and incredible, but their fucking voice was fucked up and they couldn't do it. In the same way, a lot of these fucking people who are actors and have this beautiful persona and are wearing this word costume made by brilliant writers, their fucking personality is shit. They have a steaming diarrhea personality, and the moment they're forced to actually interact, it's like, oh, there's nothing there. That's just a fucking old cancerous tooth that happens to be able to, like, wear people's words like clothes. Seems like that's the shift that's happening right now.
No, maybe- it's fantastic. And you know, I think the great thing about Twitter is, you know, most of the people, you know, that was just a weird example, but you know, most everyone I follow is a comedian.
Right.
And so just like the wave of jokes the last few days with like that Colorado shooter.
Yes.
It's awesome. Yep. And like people, you know, almost trying to top each other. And I forget who said it, but somebody said Fred Willard picked the best week ever to jack off in a movie. It's like, You know, I'm reading it on my phone. I'm howling. It's great.
No, the Fred Willard tweet I saw was Fred Willard trying to warn us.
So that's the great thing about it. I mean, it's like whatever you're into. I mean, technology is great, and you have access to all these comedic minds. And
yes. Yeah. And it's an incredible time also just to be an individual. It's the power of the individual now because of this technology is so much more than it ever has been. Because one person, like back in like the 1800s, if you decided to go to a fucking, county fair with your broadsword and just start decapitating people, and you could maybe get like 12 of them, like lob off 12 heads maybe before you.
Oh, with arrows maybe you could.
Take out some more.
If you were on a hill.
On a hill. So yeah, you decide to take your longbow.
With your longbow.
Your longbow to a hill and just start picking off people at a fucking fair for whatever reason. You dye your hair orange and you're like, fuck it, I'm going to do this. You're going to get stopped. You're going to get beheaded fairly quickly. But the amount of time it's going to take for your massacre to spread around the planet is going to be probably... If it even does spread around the planet, it's going to be years. I mean, someone's going to have to get in a boat and, like, sail to another country, another land, and talk about the longbow shooter and how he shot 12 people at a county fair. There'll be no pictures. But now, if you do something...
Yeah, and by the time, you know, that word got out, then the blunderbuss would have come out. And then,
yes.
You know, and then a copycat blunderbuss killer, and then that word takes 3 months to get out. And...
It would take forever, and it would all peter out. The blunderbuss fair killer would be unknown. But whereas now, this is the dangerous thing, and this is what's a lot more worrisome than the fucking CIA training idiots to shoot people. It's that anybody who does a violent act will become a global superstar temporarily.
Right.
And that sucks, man. Because that's...
Well, that's why I say we should only call them the human turds.
Yes.
Like, the human turd of Norway that killed those people, I was obsessed with that trial and everything. He, you know, for like a year, he like unplugged out of society, sat in his mom's house and played video games.
World of Warcraft.
And there was another one. I forget, Mortal Kombat or something like that. And so he kind of lived every like 12-year-old's dream of actually living a video game.
Yes.
Where he gets to kill people just like the video game.
Yeah.
And then this human turd in Colorado with his orange hair, he'll never be in showbiz. He wanted to be a part of the movie.
Yes.
He's part of it.
Right.
So it's, you know.
Well, no, you're right. It's the relationship that the media has with killers is one of the most incestuous, snake eating its own tail fucking relationships that there ever has been, because they act as though we're just reporting the facts.
Right.
But the reality is they're like fetishizing this thing. They're obsessed with it. There's nothing creepier than watching one of these fucking painted tarts. Like, have you noticed how the reporters are now just like, it's like they're basically strippers. They're these kind of like hot chicks, and they're wearing shitloads of fucking makeup, and they're you don't feel like they're journalists. They're going on and on with every gruesome detail, cutting to the blood trail leading out of the theater, interviews with people who are still in shock and shouldn't be on camera, talking about seeing people's heads getting blown off around them. It's like, why is that happening? I think the real culprit behind this is less the fucking Joker killer or the Aurora Dunce or the human turds, and more this massive fucking media that's giving these people, you know, that's blowing these people up. They're the ones who have to bear some responsibility for it.
But they don't whatsoever.
None.
No.
Well, we're just telling the truth. What do
you want? Yeah, but I mean, that's the ancient saying in the television news business, is if it bleeds, it leads.
Yes.
You know that. And that's local news uses that mantra.
Right.
So, you know, a bloodbath is perfect, but not, you know, the Syrian bloodbath or the Afghanistan bloodbath.
No.
Just like things that would excite us in our own homes.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
We don't give a shit about brown people getting killed.
No way. We don't care that 66,000 civilian casualties in fucking Iraq. Well, how many movie theaters is that? How many fucking movie theaters did George Bush go storming into, blasting the fucking heads off of Iraqis? How many movie theaters is 66 fucking thousand? That's a conservative estimate, by the way. I found that on Wikipedia.
I just wish that gay bomb that the government was working on would have worked.
Did they have a gay bomb?
Apparently. They tried to develop a bomb.
Yeah.
You know, an LSD comes from government experiments. They were trying to create a truth serum.
That's right.
That's how LSD was invented.
Right.
And so they were working on, for Iraq, the first Iraq war, some chemical bomb that we could drop on Iraqis and they'd all start kissing each other and making out.
That's a great fucking bomb.
That would have been the greatest bomb ever.
I'll tell you this. If I get to choose between a fucking cluster bomb landing on me or something that makes me suck a few cocks, send the gay bomb, please. It'd be a much better world if our weapons were like that. That's something that's always confused me, man. Oh my God.
I don't know what happened. I had done all this training, and I had the grenades, and I had the machine gun, and the extra ammunition, and then I'm blowing this guy.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. That's so much better than murder, man. It's so much better than killing. It's something that...
Oh, what a different world we would live in.
It's perplexing to me that if someone started, posing the idea, like, listen, here's what we're going to do. We've decided we just don't want to fucking drop bombs that rip people's bodies to pieces. We figured out a psychoactive drugs that we're just going to drop on people and they're going to start tripping really hard and they're not going to want to fight. Why can't we do that? Why is the solution to this always killing? There's so many wonderful psychoactive drugs out there that could easily be put into some kind of aerosol or sprayed over cities. Why don't we do that? Why are we so always just so into blowing people up? Doesn't make any sense. Also, by the way, if you go back and look at the accidental airstrikes that have happened in Afghanistan, the numerous people just in Afghanistan who've been killed by accidental bombs, it's so many more than what happened in that theater. You know, you're right. There's this disconnect that we have where the theater fucking, I guess we're just selfish pigs, isn't it? What upsets us is it could happen to us.
Right. And, oh, a movie. What's more, you know, cozy American pastime spot than the movie theater?
Right.
This is going to be great for stand-up comedy.
Yes.
Kidding.
Oh, I was like, oh, I think it'll be good.
Now people are going to be afraid to go to movies.
Oh, well, stand-up comedy. Yeah, that's
the serious thing. And thanks to Twitter, I found out yesterday, like very early, that one of the guys that got shot was an open mic comedian.
Yeah,
guy.
He's a comedian, and there's a fucking his wife was pregnant. He got shot in the face. There's actually
Caleb Melody, I think is his name.
That's his name.
Caleb Medley.
I'll put a link. There's a benefit. They're getting money for. He's got brain damage now. They need money. They're raising money. I'll put a link.
When you start shooting comedians, that's when I get pissed.
Yeah. Well, I know. I tweeted that link to that, and then I thought, man, is this bad that I'm just tweeting to the comedian instead of like some other chair? I mean, I don't know.
Right. See, and that's how fucked up the world is. You know, you think, oh, God, no, it wasn't good enough.
Right.
I did this one little thing, but I should have done a bigger thing.
Oh, yeah, right. That is a hilarious function of the mind, isn't it? That it immediately, no matter what, when you do a bad thing, you can feel pretty normal. Doing bad shit will just make you feel like, yeah, that's just what everyone's like. But the moment you start doing good shit, all of a sudden it's like, am I going crazy? What the fuck did I just do? Like, I used to go and buy, I used to try these little experiments. Like, I'd go and buy a rotisserie chicken and give it to, a homeless guy.
Oh, yeah.
And then I'd do that, and it's fucking fun, and I talk about it on this podcast and try to get people to do that. But I would go and do that, and I would, right after I did it, I'd be driving away being like, this is some form of nervous breakdown, dude.
Who am I?
What am I doing helping people?
What do I think? Jesus or something.
Yeah, what do I think? I'm Jesus. Is this really who you think you are? Meanwhile, cut someone off in traffic, ignore someone who asked for money, be callous or cold to someone that you know. It's just totally fucking normal.
Well, it's funny. Like, I've traveled in, you go to Vietnam or Cambodia and certain places, and you see just, abject poverty and just, people don't even have shoes and just people so poor. And you realize, God, I should really be grateful about everything in my life and, you know, in America and just all this prosperity we have. And then, you know, you make this pledge to yourself when you're in a third world country. You're like, I'm really going to appreciate things more when I get back home.
Yeah.
And then the first time you get behind the wheel, bam, bam, hey, cocklick, move it, fuck stick, you know.
Yeah.
And you forget it instantly.
Right away. How do you not forget that? How do you stay in that state of kind of like what you said on the porch there when I'm mewling about some nonsense and you point out, no, you live in paradise. What do you think is something you can do to keep yourself in that state of gratitude all the time? Is it possible?
I think there should be a television channel of human poverty around the world. We could just watch it and be reminded.
And feel better. You know what, dude? That's not a bad idea.
Just a 24-hour channel of just like the people who are living the worst possible lives.
That's a great fucking idea.
Like India, like people lying in the gutter and
so you're feeling
and shit.
This channel could be called "So You're Feeling Sorry for Yourself."
Yeah.
And anytime you start feeling down, you just turn to that channel, and it's just a camera set up on some fucking kid making his last desperate breath as the vultures are surrounding him, waiting for him to fucking die.
I've been in like Bangkok. I saw a guy with no arms and legs, and he's had a cup in his mouth. He's shaking the cup, and you can hear the coins in the bottoms. You know,
In India, I remember looking out the window down into the muddy fucking streets. It was the monsoon season. This is in New Delhi. Looking down in the streets, and I see something. And for a second, I thought it was some kind of enormous worm going through the muck. And then I realized that's a guy with no arms and no legs in India squirming like a fucking snake through the muck of New Delhi trying to get to wherever he's going. That's his life. He's literally squirming through the muck with no arms or no legs. And
He would have loved a rotisserie chicken.
Yeah, I would have had to hold it in front of his head. The poor guy. But you know what, man? It doesn't work. The problem is that technique, I can like think about that all the time, but it just doesn't work. Like somehow our minds can't do it. There's got to be some other fucking way to like get into that state of gratitude, because the weird thing about that state of gratitude is it's a potent fucking state. When you get into that state, like, have you ever taken ecstasy?
I have.
A wonderful drug. And when you're on ecstasy, you'll find that in a real way, not if you're hallucinating or it's a projection, but you'll find that not only are you relating to people in a much better way, but they're relating to you in a much better way because you're open to them and like you feel connected to them more, and it's created this situation where you're not completely shut down. So that's a potent state to be in. That's a powerful state to live in. I mean, if you could manifest gratitude all the time, it'd be incredible.
More dancing.
That's the solution?
That's it.
Really?
Yeah, we need to hire DJs, I guess.
Do you go dancing a lot?
I used to, like, especially when I lived in Amsterdam. I had lots of fun.
God damn, man. Maybe that's the key. You can kind of gauge where the fuck you are on the asshole scale by
if you dance a lot, yeah.
By how willing you would be to go dancing. Because when I think about going dancing, I'm like, oh, no, I'd never do that. I'll close down and iced over. But somebody who's like, yeah, I'd fucking dance in a second. That's a person.
Dancing is key. And I think if you're having real, like, emotional depression, a lot of 70s funk always
Parliament.
Helps. Parliament always cheers you up.
That's interesting, man. That someone recommended that to me a long time ago when I was in
Atomic Dog.
It is a potent fucking changing your fucking environment.
Yeah.
Listen to Parliament. Watch fucking indie. You know what? Put on some Parliament and watch videos of armless people squirming through the mud in India. No, the combination doesn't work that well. Yeah, it's something it's something I'm always struggling with. Is like that. But it's cool to remind people too, man. It's cool to remind people like, no, things are pretty good. It's good like to like let people know when they've gotten too far down that fucking.
Well, I mean, again, as bad as the country's been with the economy and everything, we still pretty sweet here.
Right.
Still pretty nice. You know, oh, people complain about shit, but yeah, you got a car, you got a place to live, you know, shut the fuck up.
Yeah. You shut the fuck up. Stop whining. You mewling bastards. We've got to start saying, do you believe in affirmations?
Sure.
Like positive affirmations?
Yeah, very much. Yeah.
Do you ever say any? Do you ever say any
affirmations? I mean, it's always a reoccurring issue. You know, I like quotes and reading great authors and things.
But you don't do like, you know, like...
Oh, you mean like personal mantra, kind of California walk on the hot coal shit.
Every day way, I am getting better. No, you don't do that shit?
No.
You know what, man? I think it's retarded too, but I, like, there have been times in my life when I've done it, and it really fucking works in some strange way. Like, saying, like, making yourself in the midst of some whatever awful catastrophe is happening in your life, making yourself just say...
Yeah, the power of positive energy. It affects the molecules. That's an ancient thought, and that's why comedy helps cancer patients and AIDS patients. That, you know, they'll show you know, Charlie Chaplin and Laurel and Hardy stuff. That's just changing the molecules with positivity.
Right.
That's what The Secret was about, man.
Yeah, man.
And that's why Oprah's not on the air anymore, because we all figured it out. Ha ha, Oprah.
You think The Secret? The cumulative.
Put her out of business.
The cumulative effect of people using the power of The Secret to get Oprah off the air totally fucking worked.
That was The Secret. It was a plan to get Oprah off the air. The Secret has been revealed.
She was trying to not get it published for years. Right. Years. She was paying money to not get it published, knowing once people... Man, that's fucking intense, though, because when you realize that, like, if you believe that, like, yeah, showing fucking comedy to cancer patients seems to help them. Making people laugh seems to have beneficial health effects. Saying, even if it sounds ridiculous, saying beautiful things about your life, saying my life is incredible, I'm very grateful to be alive right now, every day is a blessing, every day, this day is going to be the most incredible day of my life. Saying things like that, no matter how dumb, cheesy, and ridiculous it feels, it seems to have an impact. And if you do believe that, then you really understand how dark the fucking news is, because they're the opposite of that.
Right. It's never what's good about humanity.
Never. 24 hours a day, they are blasting out negative affirmations to the world with a machine gun rate, just blasting out awful fucking stories. Always, always death, fucking always pit bulls.
Controlling us with fear. I mean, and that's what religion has done for years. So the media's taken over that, you know, manipulation technique.
Whoa, like the media's taken the place of the priest used to have.
Right.
The media is our fucking dark priest that we worship. Man, that is the most fucked up idea ever. Because, yeah, so how do you...
I'm sorry to bum you out. You want to go back on the porch?
Yeah, let's go fucking back on the porch. Look at
let's go talk to your...
What are we doing
cute
here?
Cute mailman in his shorts and pith helmet.
What are we doing here? God, Jesus.
Hey, mailman. You know how evil and dark this world is.
By the way, though, man, nothing makes me more paranoid when I'm super stoned than a fucking mailman. I don't know why, but it just...
He works for the government, man.
That's it, yeah.
He might be here to brainwash you.
It's something about seeing...
Has my ammunition arrived yet?
They're like weird little fucking bees buzzing through the breeding grid with their packages delivering, like...
Knowing everybody's address.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'd hate to be a mailman, man. That's the worst fucking job ever.
I don't know. We make pretty good stamps. Hey, new stamps are coming out. Maybe that's not enough.
Mailmen freak out too. Going postal.
They invented it.
Holy shit. They're freaking out all the time. Well, it's because, like...
Well, it hasn't probably happened since the 90s, but, you know, we still have that image.
That's right. All it takes is one fucking terrible, one bad mailman freaking out momentarily, and it's over. It's all over for us. What? This now my podcast has turned into fucking Nancy Grace.
Can we take a break for a second?
Let's take a break.
Great. You and me both, brother.
We're back.
Oh, wow. Your mailman is such a good guy. He had thoughts on Voltaire and Camus.
Yes. Do you know a lot about Camus?
Yeah.
Man, that shit freaks me out. I've been thinking about that a lot. The myth of Sisyphus, you know, that idea of rolling the boulder up the hill.
Oh, yeah, and that we're all constantly doing that. But you got to find joy in rolling your boulder up the hill.
Yeah, that's it. The meaningless activity of rolling the boulder up the hill, somehow you find your own. You think that's really possible? I have a friend who's like deeply, deeply into existentialism, and it always ends up seeming incredible, but it weirds me out in the end somehow, you know?
I was really into it in my early 20s, reading Camus and Sartre. And I just got back into it. And I read Camus' The Fall, which I had never read before.
I'd read
The Plague and The Stranger. And The Fall is really, and it's a really thin read. He's this guy is this lawyer in Paris. And he's kind of a turd. He only cares about himself. He thinks he's noble because he represents poor people. But he's really only concerned with his own well-being. And then something happens, this little minor traffic incident where some guy on a motorcycle, he hits, and the guy ends up punching him in the nose, and everybody laughs at him, and he just gets in his car and he drives away. And he was so ashamed of this incident that he ends up, guy moves to Amsterdam, and he's living in the center of Amsterdam. And Amsterdam, if you look at it, it's shaped like a pizza. It's round and it's kind of cut up. And in the center is the red light district. It's, you know, for 500 years, it's been the seedy part of the city because it's where the ships came in and sailors. And
right.
That's why there's prostitution there. And this guy is hanging out in this, like, you know, really scummy dive bar. And Camus equates the rings of the Amsterdam canals as Dante's inner circle of hell.
Ah.
So the guy is in the inner circle of hell, living in Amsterdam. And I just wish I would have read that book before I moved to Amsterdam. why did I spend so much time there? I should have read that book.
Yeah.
Sartre is a badass, however you pronounce it.
How would you sum up
Jean-Paul Sartre?
How would you sum up existentialism? Like, if you had to give a quick
explanation. Well, Camus, he didn't want to be part of it. He just, because his writing is so deep that he's lumped in with the existentialists.
Yes.
But, you know, Sartre, he's the Muhammad Ali of the existentialists. He's, you know, his writing all basically comes down to that we're all basically responsible for ourselves. And that our actions, you know, you smoke cigarettes leads to cancer. You know, all of our, you're responsible for your own well-being, no matter what, no matter how fucked the world is. And, you know, you should just act accordingly.
But isn't the darker part of it, the thing that's like, I think they call it black hat existentialism. The thing that's underneath that is a little more sinister. Because the thing that's underneath that is that there's no essential meaning to any of this. It's just kind of an absurd and...
Right, and there is no meaning. And the meaning is, you know, try and take care of yourself. Try and enjoy... It's the Sisyphus rolling the boulder thing. It's
right.
Like, if that's your plot in life, you know, try and fucking find joy in that.
Right. Which is
right.
Like, no, I know. But listen, like, man, I understand.
You're going to bring it back to the dark side.
I don't want it to be at the dark side. It's not that. It's just that there's this, what I think about, and this is probably fairly illogical and probably something that will make me sound like an asshole. But when you look at a lot of these existentialist philosophers, like sometimes I like to look at like, people who are the forefront of things, you know? So like you look at like a Buddhist monk, like Thich Nhat Hanh or the Dalai Lama, and you've got this guy who's like clearly happy, clearly emanating this kind of joy or this, they figured something out, they're happy.
He's got his own private jet.
He's got a fucking private jet. But even you, aside from like fancy celebrity Buddhists,
if you were getting blown in a hot tub every night, you'd be smiling too.
I've run into these fucking Buddhists who just have a robe and a bowl, and they're blasting out this kind of like positive energy. You see, like Sartre, that guy looks like somebody just climbed inside of him and chewed out his fucking soul. He seems
all negativity,
just pure misery.
Yeah.
So it's this idea.
But he came to the same conclusion in life as the monk with the bowl.
In a way, they do. They're similar. That's why I bring it up, because it's like two different sides of the same idea. I mean, the Buddhists have that idea of dependent origination, I think it's called, which is a form. It feels to me like a form of existentialism, which is like we're all part of this matrix or this web of happening that at this very moment is congealed in the form of you and me having this conversation. But clearly, after a certain amount of time, we'll disincorporate and become just a worm food and dirt. and will eventually be completely forgotten. But somehow, through that, they've found this kind of amazing peace, whereas the existentialists, many of them seem just absolutely tortured by that very same fact.
They're the stand-up comedians of literature.
Yeah, right. That's a good way to put it.
I think about the Dalai Lama often. I feel really bad for that guy. I think he's got a really tough life. You imagine how boring it would be to spend that much time with Richard Gere.
Yeah, right.
I just picture the Dalai Lama sitting Richard Gere down one day and going, "You ever considered Scientology?"
Cindy, yeah.
I think that'd be more your thing.
Yeah. He does. Sometimes I do think about that guy, and I feel like he's trapped. I mean, what's he going to do? He can't get out, can he? Like, if he wanted to, could he get out?
The Dalai Lama?
If the Dalai Lama's like, "I don't want to do this anymore," could he put on like a t-shirt and beach shorts and
just ride a motorcycle around for a couple of years?
Just ride a motorcycle, yeah, out of the thing? He can't get out, can he?
I don't know.
The Dalai Lama can't quit. Like, if he tried to quit, he wouldn't be able to quit. It's like he's in a cult.
Right. I think he's born to it. It's like a royalty thing.
Yeah, but you there actually are stories of the, because in Tibet, in Tibetan Buddhism, they find these kids who pick out the right things meet the right requirements that implies that they're the incarnations of past lamas. And there's a story of one of these guys who was like this, they thought he was a reincarnation of some Buddhist, and he split when he was a teenager. He went, started going to the raves in Europe and stuff. And like, he talked about how it was like, no, it's terrible. It's a very, you're very constrained and stuck in that situation, you know? But,
well, I like Amish people. They have the choice when they're teenagers. You know, they can go out in the world and they can do whatever and experience it and do drugs and drink. And then they come back and they have to make the choice. Do I want to be Amish?
Yeah.
Do I want to live this existence?
Right. And the Dalai Lama, he's like,
he doesn't have that choice.
God damn, man. That would be insane if he just fucking quit. That would send such intense, sad reverberations through the world. Where he's like, no, I hated it most of the fucking time. I fucking hated it.
Oh, my God. Everybody coming up and wanting to kiss my ring. And
yeah, no. The robes are uncomfortable. It's the fucking sitting in that position all the time. It's boring. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I don't know. The Dalai Lama seems to be enjoying his incarnation, but the existentialists, my God, man, they seem pretty fucking eaten up. Comedians too. Do you consider yourself a tortured comedian?
No, not really.
Cause you are, I was just saying this outside, but you're like in my mind, you're like the quintessential comedian. You're touring. You've toured your entire life. You travel all around the world. You're constantly out there, man. Like, and that, I feel like that would drive me insane at some. You must have gone crazy at some point.
Oh, many times. Yeah, sure. And you know, it's comedy. Life is a long thing, and you know, you have things happen to you. You have heartbreaks with girlfriends.
Yeah.
You have family members die. Things happen, and you know, and then you know, there's things that affect your writing, and you get, you know, you have slumps, and you know, you go through cycles, and there's always been enough interesting. I've had a great career, done a lot of nice television, and I've always had, you got to make it interesting for yourself. I guess it is the Sisyphus thing, but our life, you can't even compare to that drudgery, because it's a great life, even when it sucks, even when you're starting out and doing tough gigs. You know, last year I spent a month touring in Asia.
Right.
Singapore, Kuala Lumpur, Jakarta, Bali. Then I went to Australia for a month. And that's exciting. And
right,
that's, you know, there's always things in the world of comedy that will lift you back up.
Right.
And make you feel good. As long as you're not a turd.
Right. If you're a turd, it just backfires and you end up immolating yourself, it seems like. But, I mean, that's one of the curious things about stand-up. And it kind of brings it back to that idea of standing on a porch of a house in California and complaining is like, no matter what the external situation is, or how incredible on the outside it can seem, you still, especially as a comedian, it's kind of fucking lonely, man. You're still like traveling around by yourself all over the place. And maybe there's moments where you have a girl that you bring around with you, but you're still like thwarted again and again when you end up at that empty hotel room. You know, there's still those like intense moments that.
Right. And then, you know, all of show business is designed to hurt your feelings. You know,
right.
It's easy to like see, oh, God, all these comedians are doing better than me, or why hasn't this happened? Or, I mean, no matter what position you're in, you're always going to think, you know, poor me.
Right.
But there's thousands of comedians that wish they were you.
Right. Which, right. And that's where it gets. that's the very curious thing about all this silly, this fucked up this dimension that we happen to be stuck in, is it's like, it's not the external stuff at all. It's like, it's, you know, it's the fact that no matter what's going on the outside, you're still sitting with whatever you are, whatever's inside you. That's the thing that still emerges no matter what.
Well, it's just, I don't know. We need more fun and ridicule. And that's what, you know, we were talking about that deterred in Colorado earlier.
Yeah.
And, you know, why would you hurt people when you could go into comedy?
Right.
You're making jokes and having fun. I read this thing. I've been writing for the Huffington Post.
Cool.
As a travel writer, whenever I feel like it. And, I like taking a peek at their thing. And in today's Huffington Post, on the travel section, they had this thing about Peru. And I had gone to Peru. Anything with Peru, I always look at it. I'm fascinated with the place. It's one of my favorite places I've ever been. After the late night talk show I had in Amsterdam, the same network let me do a travel program.
Cool.
Be a presenter. And I got to do a highlight on Peru. And I spent like 2 weeks traveling all over Peru. It was one of the greatest trips I've ever taken in my life. And there was a really interesting thing in the Huffington Post Travel today about some festival in Peru where these indigenous people in the mountains mock white people. And because the white Spaniards came over and oppressed them.
Right.
And did ruthless things, killing them, and they just wanted the gold and tortured Incas and stuff. So these people celebrate by getting drunk in front of this Catholic church because the Spaniards, the conquistadors, were as ruthless as they were Catholic, which was very.
Right.
So they mock the white people by getting drunk in front of their church and then having a parade where they dress up like silly white people. And then they've got their indigenous costumes as well. And I was reading that this morning. I was like, well, you know, that's the attitude, baby.
Right. Right.
You know, if you're bothered by things, why not make fun of it, make
right.
light of it instead of, you know, acting out violence.
Right. And that's not, that's like a component in the myth of Sisyphus is that it's not just that Sisyphus is rolling that fucking boulder up and down the hill and being happy about it. It's that the gods were trying to curse him. And there was this defiance in the act of being happy. It wasn't just...
Right. I'm the one who decides my life is shitty.
Yeah.
Not you. That's what it all comes down to. You've put this curse on me? No. I decide whether or not my life is enslaved and insignificant.
Yeah.
So you have to give yourself meaning and importance.
Yeah. And in that moment, you rise above the gods. Because they can't fucking get you.
That's right.
That's the whole point. They can't get you. That's the one little spark. I mean, that's why in the myths and everything, they say that part of being human is you have this spark of the infinite or the divine inside of you. And that fucking spark of the divine, if you're infinite, you can't get wrangled into somebody else's game. You know, that's something that that you can take great comfort in, is no matter what, you always get the final decision about how you're going to react to it, no matter what.
I think we just led to existential orgasm.
I just had an actual
we
real
did.
Orgasm.
I was like, wow, where this conversation started and
yeah.
what we produced, the little knowledge nugget.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
We did it. We gave birth to a nugget of knowledge. That's cool, man. Thank you so much for fucking coming on this show,
Duncan,
man.
I love you, man. Thanks
I love
for,
you too,
thanks
man.
For the, thanks for honoring me and the respect, you know?
Are you kidding, man? You're a legend. It's so cool to have you here in my house. It's amazing. It really is, man. I'm going to have tons of links to your stuff at DuncanTrussell.com, but please let people know where they can see you coming up, because people are going to want to come and see you and your website. And
I'm in San Diego this weekend at the American Comedy Company. The following weekend, I'm at the Ice House in Pasadena. Going to do some sets at the Laugh Factory. before that, and then I go to Dallas to do Hyenas.
Oh, cool. Wait, and you've got a website?
TomRhodes.net.
TomRhodes.net. Couldn't get .com. Who got .com?
A real estate mogul in Dallas.
That's so fucked up, because you know what? Joe Rogan has JoeRogan.net, and he can't have JoeRogan.com because a fucking real estate guy took it.
Well, and it's interesting. In 1999, this guy got, and he's older than me. He's a very well-off insurance real estate guy. And in 1999, he bought the domain names TomRhodes.com, TomRhodes.net, TomRhodes.org, TomRhodes.tv, everything.
Ugh.
So when I started, I went with Rhodes World was my first website.
Right.
And then I wrote the guy a nice email. And I said, you know, first of all, let me compliment you on what a lovely name I think you have.
That's good. Good start.
And so very eloquently, you know, I told him that I'm very, you know, proud of my name, and that, you know, would he consider giving me TomRhodes.net? And the guy wrote me back, and he's a really great guy. And why wouldn't he be? His name is Tom Rhodes.
Yeah.
And so he said, and the guy gave me TomRhodes.net, and he said, all I ask is free tickets for life whenever you play in Dallas.
That's
cool.
So
it was about 3 or 4 years ago. He came to the show, and I met him, and he was a really sweet guy.
That's fucking
cool.
So,
you know, so not all rich people are bad.
Tom Rhodes is a good man.
Tom Rhodes
all
is a good
Tom Rhodes
man.
Are good. Where are you on Twitter?
It's _ Tom Rhodes.
_ Tom. Did he get Twitter, too? Did he?
No. Tom Rhodes, the guy who's got at Tom Rhodes, is a soccer writer in England.
Well,
and then there's another Tom Rhodes who's a journalist in Africa who does a lot of great things. For journalist rights, and so that, you know, journalists get killed all the time, and he writes stories on war-torn regions of Africa. You know, there's a musician, Tom Rhodes, who's in the Bay Area. He's a singer-songwriter. But I'm at the top of the Googles.
That's all that matters, my friend. That's all that matters in anything. That's all that matters. That's even better than rolling that fucking boulder.
I could use some more Twitter followers.
So follow Tom on Twitter and go definitely go see him if he's around you, everyone in Dallas or wherever. It's well worth it. He's a fucking brilliant comic. Thank you so much for coming on the show, man.
Thank you, brother.
See you around. Later.
Oh, Namyo Horenge Go, Namyo Horenge Go, Namyo. Namyo Renge Go, 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 Namyo Renge